93.2 is a charity run entirely by volunteers. That means we are not for profit, so we can put you, the people of Bristol, first. BCFM 93.2, the station you can count on. You can count on.
Welcome back to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time, with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Jimmy Savile spent 11 successive New Year's Eves at Chequers, the most powerful residence in the land. Yes, the man the NSPCC have called Britain's most dangerous and prolific child molester ever as a trusted guest of Conservative Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher for 11 years on the trot. And today's police report on the 450 abuse claims Jimmy Savile committed and the 34 known rapes begs the question, why was none of this published or reported in Britain's so-called free press, nor prosecuted by the police until after he was dead? Then there's the Lord McAlpine case. Well, evidence of McAlpine's innocence of paedophile involvement has still not been tested in court. Chris Patton's BBC caved in and settled out of court. The BBC is, of course, heavily implicated in Savile's paedophilia, allowing sexual assaults to take place on BBC premises. Then there's our own Bristol case of BBC presenter and child molester Peter Rowell, now in jail, who was also one of Prince Charles's ambassadors entrusted with assessing young people as part of the Prince's trust scheme. So today, maybe some closure for the victims and their families where they're still alive, but still no justice whatsoever. And we go much deeper into this later in the programme. But first, Martin Summers, we have some very sad news this week of the death of former BBC Director General Alistair Milne, who was hustled out, we're told in The Guardian, by Marmaduke Hussey, who was the actual chairman of the Board of Governors, really Chris Patton's equivalent, back in the 1980s. This is the last honest, I would say, anyway, Director General of the BBC. He was someone who really stood up for independent programmes that criticised the government, but he criticised Margaret Thatcher's Conservative government a bit too much.
Well, yes, I mean, obviously the suspicion is that he was removed for political reasons, and you used to be a BBC employee yourself, and you'll know what
his reputation was. Well, I wasn't in the late 1980s. I mean, he was sacked in 1987, but he'd sanctioned several programmes which the government was critical of, and some parts of the military, one of which was a programme about a £500 million spy satellite that had been secretly smuggled past the Public Accounts Committee, so that was one of a series called Secret Society, another one on secret cabinet committees where massive decisions about spending on things like Trident were pushed through the cabinet with little or no scrutiny by even ordinary members of the cabinet and people who were supposed to be responsible for those roles, and really just sort of ticked, and no real discussion at cabinet taking place about funding about massive things like Trident. There was that. It
was the Shevelin programme
So there was those. There was another one about called My Country Right or Wrong about Northern Ireland, and probably most famously a programme at Panorama put out called Maggie's Militant Tendency. That is a Panorama programme looking at the far right within the Conservative Party, people like Neil Hamilton, who's been on this programme, and we asked him about it at the time, being criticised for going along to meetings of the far right, because at the time, Martin, I mean, if we can go back to the 1980s, there was a lot of criticism of the left wing of the Labour Party. What there wasn't so much criticism of, I mean, Labour militant, for example, you were referring to Derek Hatton, I think, earlier on, there wasn't a lot of criticism of the far right in the Conservative Party.
Well, I mean, the BBC basically is regarded by the Conservative Party as the enemy, because they have a public service brief, which is to, you know, cover the whole variety of political views which are expressed. And, of course, they say, well, why can't they be more objective like the Daily Mail and the Daily Telegraph? Well, the Daily Mail and the Daily Telegraph are basically conservative supporting right-wing newspapers. They're not independent, they're not middle of the road, and to compare the BBC with them is pernicious, really. But this battle goes on, and it's still going on. The government today is the current government is using the Savile affair, frankly, as a means of beating up the BBC. It's a continuous battle between Tory governments and the BBC, isn't it? It's been going on for years.
So Alistair Milne, who died this week, and his son is still actually writing and going strong, isn't he? He's a columnist for The Guardian.
Writes in The Guardian, yeah.
Now, what sort of stuff does Seamus Milne write about? I mean, I think he's actually one of the better columnists on The Guardian.
I tend to agree with most of what he says, but he'd be very close to the left wing of the Labour Party. He's not in the Labour Party, I don't think, but he's a left wing person, no doubt, a chip off the old block. His dad, Alistair, and you can see in a way why the Tories find that, well, this guy running the BBC is not one of us. But you know, at the end of the day, the people get their news from BCFM, from the BBC, from newspapers, whatever. There's no control over this, and the fact is that the mainstream press is very much biased in favour of the wealthy and people like Murdoch and so on. So the BBC just evens the balance a bit.
The other side of all this, of course, is that there was a programme called World in Action on ITV at the time, mm-hmm. which did similar kind of programmes. And I spoke on this programme, this is about 18 months ago, we did an interview with a guy called Brian Barr. I'm not sure if you remember that. He was the producer of the Secret Society series. And one of the most shocking things he was saying is that there's absolutely no way that these programmes could be made today. And now we talk about a free press, but if a producer of a controversial programme which is critical of the government now says that you can't make those programmes today, why is that?
Well, it's because the wealthy and the powerful try to control the messages that the population receives. Mr. Murdoch doesn't have all of these outlets for no reason. You know, he's got a political agenda and he's determined to push it. And basically, you know, people are constantly being bombarded with propaganda.
It does slightly frustrate me because this myth is still being propagated that it was Marmaduke Hussey that was behind all this, and as the chairman of the Board of Governors at the time. Actually, if you read Hussey's autobiography, which was released, I think, just before he died, he devotes several pages to this whole episode. He's absolutely clear that it was a so-called Labour politician, Victor Rothschild, that approached him to say, "Can you sack the Director General?" It wasn't his instigation. That there was things going on behind the scenes. Now, Victor Rothschild's an interesting character. I mean, not only connected it with the City Banking family, he was a Labour politician. You know, it's one of those bizarre times where you see somebody who you would think would be a natural Tory is actually in the Labour Party. But he was doing things, if you read Peter Wright's Spycatcher, like being one of the movers and shakers behind the scenes that was appointing Director Generals of the Security Service, MI5, and the Foreign Intelligence Service, MI6.
Well, we're fishing in very deep waters here, aren't we? The British establishment, it's like the Dance of the Seven Veils. Who's really in charge? It's a very interesting question, but we don't actually see who's really in charge a lot of the time, do we?
Well, I mean, it does indicate that there is a sort of banking fraternity obviously, you know which side your bread's buttered. If you want to succeed, you need funding to do it. And it may be that a lot of these sorts of decisions are reliant on the favour of a kind of banking. I mean, we had, for example, this week there was some discussion on Russia Today about the latest meeting of something called the Bank for International Settlements, which we very, very rarely hear about. I mean, maybe we'll talk about the World Economic Forum too in a minute. There are various of these organisations which get very little public scrutiny, some of which actively shut out the public and the press, like the Bank for International Settlements. But this is a sort of club in Bern in Switzerland, and Basel, sorry, in Switzerland, where all the central bankers from across Europe and of course the United States as well, all get together once every 2 months and basically decide what economic policy is going to be, and the public really don't get much of an input, Martin.
No, they don't, and I think this is what people have got to realise, is that the real power isn't actually in the hands of elected politicians. The elected politicians also depend very much for their power on funding, and therefore, in actual fact, democracy gradually, bit by bit, insofar as we had ever had any, is gradually being eroded, because it's quite clear, whoever you vote for, the economic policy is going to be determined by the bankers who ought to be in prison.
And what about, this sacking of Alistair Milne? I mean, he was also someone who was a programme maker, had come from the Tonight programme and from what was, I suppose, in those days, their equivalent of Newsnight. I mean, he'd, I think, been involved in satirical programmes too, like That Was the Week That Was. So he was from a very different tradition to these kind of businessman type director generals that I have now, because he really is, the director general is the sort of creative head of the organisation. And I wonder if we'll ever see another Alistair Milne kind of person running the BBC again in the future.
Most unlikely. Why did they remove him in the first place if they were going to replace him with somebody like that?
What are your thoughts then about the future of the BBC compared to the Murdoch Empire? Because these are two very powerful, massive media organisations. I mean, the news we take on here is from Murdoch. Ujima, the other community station in the city here, has the BBC news on the half an hour still, I think. I mean, there isn't a lot else out there, is there, as regards big media companies?
I think the problem with the BBC is that because they are regarded as a sort of voice for the liberal centre, sometimes they don't cover things from a left-wing perspective, from my point of view, but they are far and away better than commercial TV news, far and away better, because the point being that they are independent of proprietors, and the rest of them aren't.
But what about the fact that the commercial side, the ITV networks, ITV1, for example, they have to, and what used to be HTV, ITV West here in Bristol, they're having to fight for advertising. They have to have a good news service. People have to be watching it, otherwise the advertisers
don't pay. But also the advertisers will want you to be taking certain lines on the news and not other lines. And of course, you know, the whole, especially in wartime, the use of the media. And of course, we've got a permanent war on terror, so the media are on a war footing permanently. Basically, they're part of a propaganda exercise to keep the population in line. And I'm afraid people have got to learn to use media rather than being used by the media. And one way they can do that is by listening to this show, Tony.
Okay, and because I did mention World in Action, which was one of my, if anyone out there really wants to get into some of this, there are DVDs of our World in Action programs, some of which are absolutely gobsmacking.
There's one on iPlayer this week. It was on this week
on ITV.
ITV, the World in Action,
and it is. So you can look it up on the old the ITV player thing. I'm not quite sure. Is it called iPlayer? No, I think it's ITV player.
Yeah, yeah.
And if you look up on there, just put World in Action into that. I think it's available for another month or so to watch. But there was a retrospective this week on World in Action, and we're going to hear a little clip from that right now.
Tonight, a personal report by the Daily Mirror's special correspondent, John Pilger. Vietnam, 1970. The front line.
I hadn't been to Vietnam for 3 years. What is there left to say? Surely we've seen it all on telly. But our boredom has not made the war go away, so I've come back for the final act. No blood, no atrocities. Just the rejection of the war by those sent here to fight it. Just the quiet mutiny of the greatest army in history.
When the show went out, the American top brass were furious.
The war is ending because the grunt is taking no more bullshit.
I just can't take too much pressure from the army.
What happens to an unpopular officer out in the field?
Mostly unpopular officers, if they mess with a grunt too much, they get shot out
there. A friend of mine, captain, got shot in the back.
World in Action evolved in the 70s into be a harder, more investigative, focused program.
The man, John L. Paulson, once one of the world's top architects, who built up a business which brought him power, prestige and millions of pounds in contracts.
We made a one-hour program, and it demonstrated that there was corruption of every level of government in Britain. The Broadcasting Authority refused to accept or believe this and banned the programme. Granada had to transmit in World in Action's slot the flight of the snow goose.
So there's a little clip from that excellent hour and a quarter, roughly an hour long retrospective on the World in Action series. Martin, what's your thoughts about why these kind of programmes simply aren't being made now? I mean, we touch on some really controversial issues on here, none of which, many of which, are just simply not looked at in investigative programmes anymore. There used to be series such as This Week. We had the Cook Report. Remember, we spoke to Roger Cook late last year about the demise of his programme when it was taken to pieces by lies printed in the News of the World. Why is it that there's so little real investigative journalism going on?
Because the investigative journalism of that era ruffled feathers at the top. I mean, at one stage, the powers that be, as it were fairly blasé about the media. They just saw it as a means of focusing the population on things that they were interested in. And then people came along and started exposing corruption and, American soldiers saying, well, casually, we shoot our officers. You can imagine the American top brass getting upset about that. But then it was their war and they had it coming. But, of course, ultimately, the powers that be have decided no, we've got to have much more control than that over what people see, and they've been fighting a war ever since that era, as it were, through the institutions to make sure that the population do only see infotainment and that they're not given any challenging information that makes them think.
So where is that information? Is it just the internet?
Well, I think what's happened, obviously, is that the alternative media, local radio like this, non-commercial radio and the internet, have done an end run around the control mechanisms by which the media used to be manipulated by, the military and the government. But, of course, the problem with the internet is there's just so much of it, and people are overwhelmed by the amount of information, and it's very hard to judge what's accurate and what's not.
Okay, now here's the $64,000 question. Give us a couple of websites to go to find some real good investigative journalism and also some something which is going to challenge your preconceptions.
Well, investigative journalism as a whole is actually very difficult to run, because a lot of investigative journalism, I spoke to an investigative journalist years ago, and he said of 10 investigations I'll be carrying out, only one will ever go into print. So it's very expensive to run investigative journalism. You've got to have lawyers coming out of your ears to cover every angle. And it can be done very well, but it's expensive. And, of course, the problem with the internet is it's undermining journalism, because anybody can be a journalist, which is fine, but then who's going to be paid to actually do those investigations? And that's a problem. And I think that is an issue for going forward, basically.
Well, I suppose one of the difficulties is what we're going to be coming back to talking about, what Brian Barr was saying, is that simply it's impossible to get these investigative documentaries commissioned nowadays. Even if you go to a commissioning editor with a pretty robust story, an investigation you've done yourself, it simply won't be made to be shown on TV. And I suppose this is reflected, I mean, particularly young people simply don't watch television nowadays.
No, and I think the media world is moving on. You mentioned websites earlier. A website I use very every day is called whatreallyhappened.com. It's a US-based website. The guy's based in Hawaii, but they have 60 or 70 new posts gleaned from the English language press all over the world. The political views of the guy who runs it are rather eccentric. He's a sort of right-wing American, but there's a massive amount of really good information there. And also globalresearch.ca, which is a Canadian website, that's run by Michel Chosadovsky, who's an economics professor, and that's much more academic. If you want academic analysis with proper references and all the rest of it, that's where you go. What Really Happened is the scuttlebutt.
And I suppose it's to round up this discussion, it's worth saying that ITV seem to have a bit of new lease of life, doing several documentary programmes now. At least there are some of these investigative programmes being made, even if they're not necessarily on the right topics. I suppose that's another side to all this, Martin, isn't it? That you can make an investigative documentary and it can be shown, but there are certain topics which are virtually taboo.
There are, and you can guess which ones they are.
I mean, if we imagine someone like Pilger doing a programme about Afghanistan now, along the lines of that Vietnam programme you made back in 1970.
Well, I mean, there are some people out there who are independently reporting it, but of course, if you're embedded with, the military have really got on top of the idea of controlling the message. In Vietnam, they felt that they lost because they lost control of the message. You've got people like Pilger and Walter Cronkite wandering around talking to soldiers who are casually talking about shooting their officers, and you can see them, tearing their hair out. But on the other hand, it's true. They were shooting their officers because they didn't want to fight the war, and they lost.
What are your thoughts about Afghanistan, how that's going? Because it all seems to be conking out, doesn't it, really?
The horror goes on. I mean, there's a British soldier shot this week. I was reading the Daily Mail. Shot by an Afghan traitor, it said. Well, many in Afghanistan would regard the boy who shot him as a hero, I'm afraid. And that's just the way it works in wars.
Drive Time on BCFM. 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Well, another obituary this week is the Oh What a Lovely War writer, Charles Chilton, who wrote the original stage play, which led to that wonderful film, which was made in 1969, I believe. Martin, Oh What a Lovely War, quite a classic, really, in a lot of ways. Is it a film that you've seen, you've watched?
Oh, yes. I mean, it's very influential on modern thinking about that era, about the First World War, isn't it?
And it does in a kind of strange way. I mean, it sort of mingles the songs that were sung by the soldiers in the trenches in World War One with a kind of satire of the leadership. And in many ways, it links up with what we were saying with Tony Hibbert, the major from the 1st Airborne Division, who was at Arnhem in the Second World War, also saying that ultimately the leadership they were seemed to be incompetent. When they were really needed and really necessary, they either weren't there, made the wrong decisions, or ran away.
Well, yes, and also, you know, it just reminds us of the terrible history of the 20th century. I mean, I understand the government is saying that in 2014 we're going to have a massive celebration of World War One, which I think is rather odd, frankly. I mean, maybe in 2018 we can celebrate the armistice, but I don't think we should actually be having a big celebration of 1914. It was one of the biggest human catastrophes that has ever taken place, and it led directly to the catastrophe of 1939. And of course, the catastrophe, we're now on the edge potentially of an even bigger catastrophe.
So in what way did the First World War lead so directly to the Second World War? Surely they're two different events.
If you know, the historians regard them as one war with a gap, basically. I mean, it was the struggle for hegemony within the world system, who was going to dominate it, you know, the Anglo-Americans or the Germans.
I mean, there was also the financial crisis in Germany in the 1930s, wasn't there?
Well, there's a financial crisis everywhere, and financial crises in Germany.
But I mean, it was particularly well known in Germany because of the mass runaway, was it called hyperinflation?
Yeah, what they had is hyperinflation because of the reparations which were imposed on the Germans by the West. I mean, the view was that they'd started it, therefore they had to pay, and of course it didn't work. You can't make a whole country pay in that way, and if you impoverish Germany, all you're doing is impoverishing yourself. People didn't realise that, and of course the Germans got round that by printing money, which led to hyperinflation, which led to the middle class losing their savings. Then the stock market crashed in 1929 in the US, and then everybody was made unemployed. And once you've wrung people out by losing all their savings through inflation and then throw them on the dole, they're ready to listen to a Hitler, aren't they?
Now, one of the weird things is this has come around full circle, this discussion, because the bank that was set up after World War One in order to administer the reparations for pre-Nazi Germany was something called the Bank for International Settlements. Now, that's the same exact bank that Mervyn King is going along to. In fact, he chairs, I believe, the committee there of central bankers to discuss the best economic policy for the Western world every 2 months in Basel in Switzerland. The Bank for International Settlements, I think I'm right in saying that the Bretton Woods Conference after World War II, they actually passed a resolution there saying that this bank should be closed down because it was used to help fund the Nazis. And yet it still carried on after World War II, and now it's right in the driving seat with all of these central bankers going there to Basel in Switzerland, to the Bank for International Settlements, which is their headquarters used to be over the top of a chocolate shop, a totally anonymous headquarters, up until I think the late 1980s, early 90s, in order to sort of keep the place secret. And it was opposite Basel railway station, apparently. You come to the railway station, walk across, go by the side of this through an anonymous door. It's almost like something out of a film, you know, you can't make this stuff up. And then they built their massive headquarters in Basel, which is now known as the Tower of Basel.
Yes, so interestingly, one of the guys who used to head up the Bank of International Settlements, whose name I have forgotten, sadly, was one of the few people who was sounding warnings about the the bubble before it burst, saying, look, we're going to have a crash here, folks, we're going to have a crash here. And he did a presentation, apparently, at the IMF or whatever, and saying, look, you know, this is all out of control, and it was ignored. So even people, you know, somebody's got to be, you know, there's got to be some kind of structure there. The question is it transparent, and how is it accountable? And the answer is, well, it's not transparent and it's not accountable.
So, I mean, in a way, this links up also with what we were talking about George Ferguson, doesn't it? This guy who's been elected in Bristol to basically manage the slow collapse of public services. Really, the real big decisions are being made in Basel, not even in Brussels or in London.
No. Well, the real big decisions are going to be made by, you know, the international markets as they all decide that they've got no confidence anymore.
I mean, what they're doing, Martin, you can understand in a way from their point of view, is they don't want to see the whole system collapse. They're trying to kick the can down the road rather than face up to the, you know, what might be a crash or a mass default.
Yes, but I mean, the problem is that the austerity policies they're pursuing will bring on exactly what they fear.
But what other policy can they have?
Well, what they should have done, in my view, is if you are going to bail out the banking system, and I've got more sympathy now with those who were saying in the 19, you know, it took 4 years ago, well, perhaps we should have just let the banks collapse. But if you let the banks collapse, what you're saying is the wealthy must lose their money and capitalism is over. And that's why we can't do that, because we've got to have capitalism, we've got to have banks, we've got to try and pretend that the private banking system still exists, even though it's basically dependent on funds from the drug cartels and the taxpayers.
Is it feasible to just simply nationalise it?
Yes, we have nationalised it. The fact is that we haven't. All that means is that we're chucking money down a hole, and they're still taking their bonuses.
So what you're saying is that although we have ownership of it, we're not actually using that ownership to control it.
Yeah, because if we were to control it, you'd be moving beyond a market economy and basically decisions about investment being made by, you know, on wider criteria.
But I mean, we need to move beyond this market economy. Surely if the market is heading for a crash, we do.
Yes, we do.
So why don't they?
Because the left wing, including the Labour Party, had given up on the idea of abolishing capitalism, and then they were really shocked when capitalism abolished itself, and they didn't know what to do about that. And they're still reeling from trying to comprehend the fact that we thought capitalism was stable and was just there.
Okay.
But it isn't.
What about this thorny issue of tax havens as well, though? Because obviously, if you're going to actually collect money from those that are very, very wealthy and have done quite nicely, I mean, we were talking last week, weren't we, about the bizarre situation we've got in West Somerset, with West Somerset Council saying going bankrupt, even though in the census it comes out as one of the highest areas of personal property ownership anywhere in the country. So obviously there's a massive amount of wealth that people have built up and they've got in their own homes, and yet though the council are saying, well, we can't tax them, we're going to go bankrupt.
Well, yes, I mean, it's part, but what is public, private affluence and public squalor. I mean, the fact of the matter is, I mean, the Prime Minister himself has said this is like a war. Now, if it's like a war, let's get into the Cayman Islands, let's get into Jersey, let's get into Luxembourg, let's get into Switzerland, let's get the money out of there and reboot our economy. And we say, oh, we can't do that because, no, it's an emergency, because we are actually at war with a criminal ruling class. And when I say criminal, we didn't really touch on this in the first hour. The simple way to deal with this is to arrest most of those concerned, convict them properly for the frauds they've been involved in, and take all their assets. Not raise taxes on them to 50% or 60%, just confiscate their assets. That'll cover the deficit.
I mean, would you also arrest Mervyn King for taking £3,500 out of everyone's pension?
Well, he's an official, and he's therefore culpable to some extent, as they all are, for not seeing this coming and all the rest of it. But what we've actually got here is criminal activity, and this is of course the Achilles heel of all of this. If we had the will, and maybe we're going to find the will to punish the criminals concerned, they knew what they were doing when they were slicing and dicing these subprime mortgages and all the rest
of it. Well, there's certainly evidence that the LIBOR guys knew exactly what they were doing. In chat rooms, there's all sorts of,
they knew exactly what they were doing, just like the boy who stole the water during the rioting August before last knew exactly what they were doing. But they thought they could get away with it, and they are getting away with it. HSBC has been fined as an institution a fraction of what they were money laundering, but no individual has been fined. Now, that is basically a licence to steal. And if we carry on allowing a licence to steal, the dilemma for the political leaders is, if we do start going after these people as they ought to be gone after, then the banking system will collapse, so we can't do that. It's like having somebody with a suicide vest sitting in the room with you. If we try and get the, you know, if we try and do anything, they'll pull the ripcord.
So I suppose the only way to do it really is have sort of dawn raids on bankers on a Saturday morning, and then hopefully on the, by the time we get to Monday, there won't be a collapse in the markets.
If that was going to happen, we'd have done it. I think what's going to happen is there's going to be a collapse, a serious collapse, and at that point, the population will wake up from the their stupor and realise what's happened. Because what's actually happening at the moment, the quantitative ease and all the rest of it, is the speculating classes, the tiny minority that make money out of lending money, are basically stealing everything that isn't nailed down. They're going to end up with everything, and the rest of us are going to end up with nothing.
Well, I know the Rothschilds and the Rockefellers all got together, didn't they, last year? They set up a company specially to do that, to buy up these distressed assets. Ultimately, this is a wide-ranging discussion after talking about Oh, What a Lovely War, the film, and about the First World War and the Second World War.
It's about history, though, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, and it's a background to it all. But, I mean, surely the bankers, they are planning for a... They're used to this. They're planning for a crash, and they're planning to make a lot of money out of that crash.
There's plenty of people who are going to make money out of a crash. That's what, I mean, what a crash is basically the wealthy taking their money away from the stock market and putting it in something else. That causes the stock market to crash. So ultimately, you then end up with a situation with mass unemployment all over the planet, not just Britain. That will lead to civil war, like we've seen in Syria and other places. And people are already dying. That's already started. And there's loads of violence going on in Iraq, which people haven't been paying much attention to. The danger is that we're going to have a banking collapse plus a major Middle East war, which could turn into a world war because of the Russian army and navy are in Syria, and then, you know, it's not going to be funny for anybody.
Well, I mean, it has to be, Martin. You better start formulating your plans to deal with this, because we do need to have some sort of counter to.
Well, the answer is quite simple: is that once capitalism has imploded, then that is out of the question. We can't run it like that anymore. And then we'll start to think about what needs to be done.
Well, don't we need to be thinking about that now?
We need to be thinking about that now. There needs to be a solid plan B? Redistribution of wealth. Well, I think my role within the Labour Party is just to remind people that you can't just fudge this, and that when we get to power, which we probably will get to at some point in the not-too-distant future, it's no use just tinkering at the edges. The problem is that nobody wants to accept the reality. The ordinary
population. But we do, and our listeners do. Many of them do, Martin.
Yeah, yeah.
So
we and our listeners may do, but we shouldn't overestimate. Ordinary people are still under the influence of...
But if you keep thinking like that, you're never going to have a plan, are you?
No, I mean, we need to develop a plan. I mean, people like Steve Keen in Australia, who's an economist that I really rate, he is talking in terms of what really needs to be done. I mean, it's actually not rocket science. It's the kind of thing we did in the 1940s, which is we want a health service. Well, we're going to have one. We want a green technology. Well, we're going to have it. Oh, but the market won't do it. Well, if the market won't do it, we're going to do it anyway. But then you'll squeeze the market out and there won't be any market left. Well, so be it. So be it.
Okay, so, yes, our discussion really was about Oh, What a Lovely War, wasn't it? And the writer Charles Chilton, who died aged 95 this week. If people haven't seen that, I would definitely recommend the DVD or to go and watch it at some point.
Was it not the Imperial War Museum that got their copies from you, I remember?
Actually, the British Army Museum. Because a long time, it wasn't available on DVD and I was selling it online. You know, I sold a few copies of it, but I was rather annoyed that, that you go to all these DVD stores and Oh, What a Lovely War wasn't on DVD. Yeah. I got an old copy of it on VHS, actually, which had been at 20th Century Flicks, I think. But that's the video shop up in Clifton by the university. And but anyway, let's have a listen now to a little clip from Oh, What a Lovely War. The writer of the original screenplay, not the screenplay, but the play that it was based on, Charles Chilton, died aged 95 this week. Oh, What a Lovely War.
In faraway Tibet, the Dalai Lama has placed his prayers at the disposal of the Allies. Now, brethren, tomorrow being Good Friday, we hope God will look kindly on our attack. We will now sing from Hymns Ancient and Modern, number 358.
The church is one foundation. We are the right side. Infantry, sweet as hearts, we never shoot or play.
there from the Richard Attenborough film, Oh, What a Lovely War. The writer of him, Charles Chilton, died aged 95 this week.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Well, it's Tony Gosling here with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Martin, there's also been an assassination, I think it was yesterday, in Paris, of one of the founders of the PKK. Just talk about the significance of that.
Well, people may not know what the PKK is. It's the sort of Kurdish separatist movement in Turkey. I mean, I'm not a big expert on these things, but there's some talk of a negotiated solution between the Turkish government and the PKK, who have bases inside Turkey and also over the border in Iraq. Abdullah Öcalan, who is one of the founders of the PKK, has been imprisoned in Turkey for quite a while, and there is some kind of negotiation going on potentially, and I presume this assassination, whoever's carried it out, is in relation to this negotiation.
Well, I mean, she was Sakin Kansis, who's the co-founder of the PKK, was among three women found dead in an office building with bullet wounds to the neck and chest in Paris yesterday morning. She was in the process of arranging peace negotiations, so that's a little bit strange. She should be shot at that stage.
So she might have been assassinated by the Turks, who don't want to, the Turkish army, or she might have been assassinated by other factions within the PKK who don't want a peace negotiation. I think this is one for the French police, isn't it?
Yes, well, maybe. I mean, certainly the Kurds are questioning already the ability of the French police to actually do that job.
Yeah, well, I mean, the question is that things like this don't get properly investigated because of all the political shenanigans that go on around it. Don't forget that the French are very heavily involved in backing the Free Syrian Army inside Syria, because it used to be a French colony. And of course, Assad is, the Turks are, he's captured Turkish special forces inside Syria helping his enemies. And he's saying, right, well, I'm just going to give a helping hand to the PKK to make trouble for you inside Turkey. And you can see how this war in Syria can spill over into Iraq, into Lebanon, into Turkey, just like that. And it won't just be about Syria. It'll be the whole mosaic will just break down. And this, of course, is part of an overall plan for domination by the Anglo-financial elites. But the Russians are pretty clearly drawing a line in the sand in Syria. We talked the other week about them putting their Iskander missiles into Syria and the Americans having to withdraw their aircraft carriers. So we're looking at a sort of, banks that are on the brink of collapse and a war that's just about to kick off, which might involve nuclear weapons. Happy New Year, everybody.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Another bit of news, actually better, much better this time, in Haaretz, Israeli paper. Netanyahu's got letters from more than 700 Jewish clergy protesting settlement expansion. Now, this sort of shows the lie of whether Netanyahu is doing something which the Jewish clergy, the rabbis, actually really support, Martin. It's a bit of an interesting one, because, I mean, we tend to think of Netanyahu as a Jewish leader as someone who's sort of following what the rabbis are saying. It doesn't seem he is.
Not necessarily at all. I mean, the very observant Jews don't recognise the state of Israel at all. They think it's an idolatry. And Netanyahu is a secular nationalist, a chauvinist in the 19th century terminology. And of course, there's massive differences of opinion in the Jewish community about his policies.
And if you want to follow some of those, you can follow my Twitter feed if you dare, if you like to. That's at Tony Gosling, just one word, and some of those stories have been on there, plus a few more as well. Anyway, the man the NSPCC have called Britain's most dangerous and prolific child molester ever, Jimmy Savile, spent 11 successive New Year's Eves at Chequers, the most powerful residence in the land, as a guest of Conservative Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher. And today's police report on the 450 abuse crimes Jimmy Savile committed and the 34 known rapes begs the question, why was none of this published or reported in Britain's so-called free press, nor noticed by the police and prosecuted by them until after he was dead? Then there is the Lord McAlpine case. Evidence of McAlpine's innocence from paedophile involvement has still not been tested in court. Chris Patton's BBC caved in and settled out of court. The BBC is, of course, heavily implicated in Savile's paedophilia, allowing sexual assaults to take place on BBC premises. And I suppose I ought to also point out that both Lord McAlpine and Chris Patton are both Tories. There is still our own Bristol case as well. BBC presenter and child molester Peter Rowell, who's now in jail. He was also one of the Prince Charles's ambassadors entrusted with assessing young people as part of the Prince's Trust scheme. So today may be some closure for victims and their families if they're still alive, but still no justice. Those that censored the transmission of Liz McKean's December 2011 Jimmy Savile Newsnight expose are still working at the BBC. Only the Director General George Entwistle was given a big payoff to walk. BBC under former Bath Tory MP and Cabinet Minister Chris Patten, of course they're both colleagues of each other. So I spoke to Michael Shrimpton about this very issue and first put to him questions about the Jimmy Savile and if he thought that the Tory party had really come clean about what Savile had been up to.
I'm Michael Shrimpton. My day job is barrister. I used to be an immigration judge many years ago. My other job is as an intelligence and national security consultant. I've just written my first major book, Spy Hunter. We weren't getting anywhere in the intelligence community. We were being blocked persistently and consistently in London and Washington, and it seemed to me that only by bringing public pressure to bear on politicians could you actually get anywhere. It's extraordinarily frustrating. Intelligence is about speaking truth to power, but if there's nobody in power able to act on the intelligence, then it's a little bit pointless gathering it in the first place. And there are people still alive who are involved in the paedophile scandal, and obviously I'm not going to name them on a radio program, but the most prominent paedophile associated with the Savile Ring was a man called Edward Heath, who you may recall was Prime Minister, and took us into the EEC. And Heath was recruited as something that Christopher Story published in 2005, something which was confirmed to me by General Obus Marcus Wolfe of the DVD and the Stasi. Heath was recruited by the Germans in 1937. I've said this in Spy Hunter. Heath was into little boys, and Savile was supplying them. A number of these boys were taken out of the Haute de Garenne home in Jersey. Savile was taking children from a children's home with the support of German assets in Jersey. Remember, the Germans used to run Jersey. And whenever the Germans overtake somewhere, there's always a stay-behind intelligence organization. German assets didn't pull out of Jersey in 45. Only German troops marched out, they surrendered. The German intelligence operation in Jersey stayed on after 45. Jersey was very important to the Germans because of offshore financing, because we do a lot of our offshore financing through Jersey. The banking in Jersey is quite interesting. And what was happening was that children's homes in the Channel Islands, particularly Haute de Garenne in Jersey, children were being taken from these homes, boys in the case of Edward Heath, as he was gay, and a paedophile, were being taken onto his yacht, the Morning Cloud. There were in fact several Morning Clouds, but there was one in particular which won the Sydney Hobart Yacht Race, which was eventually sunk in the English Channel, from memory. But it was the boat that was sunk on which most of the abuse took place. Savile was actually going out to, he went down to Jersey, and he was actually taking boys. There was another man involved as well, but Savile himself took boys from the children's home, where he was a guest, or welcome, onto the boat. So he was taking boys out onto Morning Cloud. Now, since Heath was well known, and since the boys were talking young men, depends how you define child, but as a lawyer, one wouldn't define, normally we define children as under the age of 14, which is the age of criminal responsibility. They were about that age, sadly, but they were old enough to know who was abusing them. It's quite clear that in most cases they weren't willing to be abused, and even if they were, we, at that age, we don't regard consent as informed consent. Defined in the United States have a phrase, statutory rape. The boys were murdered and thrown off the boat. Now, a very courageous Jersey police officer who was aware of the paedophile ring, was aware that boys were being supplied to politicians and key figures in Jersey, knowing that children had gone missing from the nursing, and there's no dispute about that, the police in Jersey were aware that they had missing kiddies. Their theory, which is quite perfectly reasonable theory, was that they must be buried in the grounds. And I think you, if you look at the files, you'll see there was an attempt to find their remains by digging up the grounds. Was it Lenny Harper? It's been some time since I looked at the file on this, but if you told me it was Lenny Harper, I wouldn't dispute that for a moment. What I do know is this police officer was very competent, very courageous, because he was up against a cabinet office-backed paedophile ring, and the investigation he was conducting was at some professional risk, and indeed, I suspect his life was also at risk at one point, because he was getting close to some very uncomfortable truths for certain people in the cabinet office, GO2 in London, and certain people in Jersey, in the German network, which is, even today, there's still a German network in the Channel Islands. His theory that the boys had been buried in the grounds of the nursing home is a perfectly reasonable one, a good copper. Good theory, but wrong. The boys were in fact being taken to a boat, it happened to be a Bethesda boat, or yacht, and they were murdered and thrown overboard, so there's no point, sadly, in looking for their graves. They don't have any grave except the sea. That's why the BBC and the Cabinet Office have been so keen to protect Savile. That's why the Cabinet Office in the 1980s were willing to back Savile to the point of giving him a position of authority at Broadmoor, which is an absolute... You know, you don't put a paedophile in charge of Broadmoor. It's just like putting a lunatic in charge of the asylum, or a drunk in charge of a brewery, or David Cameron in charge of a government, no offence intended. The Cabinet Secretary at the time, who thankfully is no longer with us, Hunt, was also a paedophile, was in on this, met Savile. He was Catholic, met Savile, as did that very nice man, the late Archbishop of Westminster, Cardinal Basil Hume. Basil was not a paedophile, but knew Hunt and had a shrewd idea. He wasn't stupid. He had a shrewd idea of what had been going on, and I've no doubt was told to keep a lid on it. Hunt was in on it, so the Cabinet Secretary at the time was in on it, was aware of what was going on, was aware he had a Prime Minister who was involved not just in abusing young boys, but was murdering them as well. It's quite possible that there was a crewman on the yacht who did the actual murder. I'm not saying it, but he necessarily bashed the boys on the boko and tossed them overboard. He may have had somebody do that for him, but he was certainly guilty of murder under English law as an accessory or on a joint enterprise basis. The Cabinet Secretary of the day knew that we had a Prime Minister who was vulnerable to charges of murder at the Old Bailey. Bit of a national security mess. And the Cabinet Secretary, as you can well imagine, was very keen to keep a tight lid on things. Hunt, of course, was working for the Germans and was very keen on British membership of the EEC. And it was Hunt and Heath between them who were responsible for Britain going to the EEC, along with another German spy exposed in Spy Hunter called Tony Barber.
Now, you're painting a picture of lots of sort of high-level paedophile characters in the centre of government. What on earth purpose would that serve?
Oh, if someone is inclined in that direction and you can supply them with boys, then you've got a hold on them, or girls. There's nothing worse for a politician than being exposed in the murder and sexual abuse of young people. And if you've got a politician who is abusing and killing young girls and boys, but boys or girls, then you've got a hold on them. This has been a standard German intelligence tactic for decades.
Well, surely it's not just the Germans. I mean, the British intelligence surely are using these kinds of tactics. Any intelligence service would want to.
No, we're the good guys. I mean, MI5 and MI6 don't do murder. Obviously, occasionally it's necessary to take people out, but that's always done by independent contractors. We're the good guys.
You're English, you would say that, wouldn't you?
Well, I am British. I'm in favour of the British, and I certainly count myself as a patriotic Englishman, and I am a Britisher, yes. But we are the good guys, and one of the reasons why we're the good guys is we don't approve of the killing of children. We'd never get British intelligence setting up a shooting like the Sandy Hook shooting in the United States, which again was set up by the Germans via Mexico, and a bunch of crazy Mexican drug gangsters rolling up to a school shooting up the kiddies. I mean, it's just absolute nonsense. British intelligence would never touch an operation like that with a barge pole.
I mean, you've said yourself that parts of British intelligence have been infiltrated by other countries, so, I mean, you know, how can you say we would never do such a thing?
Oh, well, then it's not we, is it? If a German... let's take the assassination of David Kelly. That was done by GO2, which is the German operation in London, and you've got German assets inside Thames Valley Police, for example. Where you've got Brits working for the Germans, then you, in my view, is you blame the Germans. You don't blame the Brits, because okay, the Germans are paying them or blackmailing them. Paedophilia is a wonderful means, if you're a hostile intelligence agency, of blackmailing politicians. The reason it's particularly disgusting, quite aside from the element of sexual abuse and coercion and corruption of young people, that's disgusting in and of itself. But what makes it particularly vile, and we saw this in the Madeleine McCann case, and that's why the Madeleine McCann case was so heartbreaking and tragic. If the children are, and I'm afraid with paedophilia, we sometimes have babies being abused, but if you're not talking babies, if you're talking toddlers who are able to recognize the people who are abusing them, since the people, there's absolutely no point doing it unless the politician is high profile. Since you're talking about people who are on television, people who are high profile, you have to murder the children in order to protect your asset. So for the Germans, it was essential that the boys that were being taken onto the yacht, that was a death ride. When Jimmy Savile was taking, let's say, a 14-year-old boy down to Morning Cloud, handing him over to Edward Heath or a member of the crew on the yacht, it was a death ride. That was that boy's last journey on Earth, because there was no way in the world, recognizing Edward Heath, that he could be allowed back on shore. And Savile must have known this, and that's partly why Savile was probably deeply into religion. You often find this, in fact, that where people get involved in murder, their consciences start to eat at them, and they suddenly turn to religion late in life, and Savile, certainly there are signs that he did that. It's quite a nice thing about human beings. We generally find murder very difficult. It's a lot more difficult to do than you might think reading spy novels. He'd also, I'm sure, at Edward Heath. Because you've got to murder the kiddies in order to protect your asset, supplying of children to paedophile politicians is an extremely messy, murderous, dangerous business. The case of Madeleine McCann, as I reveal in Spy Hunter, it was in my report to the Joint Intelligence Committee, which was put on the website disgracefully by the Daily Mirror a few years ago. In the case of Madeleine McCann, she was going to be abused by a senior member of the European Commission in Brussels, whose name is known to British intelligence. I can't identify him in Spy Hunter, but I do know who it is. And there was no way that Madeleine could ever be returned alive to her family, because the danger would be that even at her tender age of 4, she would recognize him and know who was abusing her. So the Germans had to murder her, and indeed they eventually did, sadly, in December 2008.
Yes, you paint again this picture of a rather horrific situation where our leaders are all compromised by these kinds of criminal acts. I mean, what hope is there for humanity, and what hope is there for Britain?
Well, the answer is to get politicians in who are not compromised. Now, I don't wish to say anything about David Cameron. I'm certainly not suggesting he's a paedophile, he isn't.
I mean, our political parties, Michael, seem to be getting worse at the top, the leadership quality. I mean, for example, somebody for the Labour Party leadership who would have been quite a positive leader for the country, Robin Cook, it looks like he may have been murdered. So where we've got good politicians coming up, they seem to sort of disappear one reason or another, or get discredited, and the only ones that seem to survive to lead the parties, all the three main parties, appear to be people who are one way or another have sold their souls.
Well, I think listeners will understand why I have to give a cautious answer to this question. Your basic premise is right, that politicians can be compromised, that where they're compromised, then it's deeply contrary to the national interest. And the answer is to replace politicians with leaders who are not compromised. You're absolutely right about Robin. Robin and I got on quite well. Certainly when I first got to know Robin Cook, there wasn't a lot of distance between us. He became more pro-European. I became increasingly Eurosceptic, although I was very Eurosceptic to begin with. So Robin and I politically grew some distance apart. But he was very pleasant, and I was a Labour candidate at the same election. He was a Labour candidate, obviously, for a safe seat, and I was for a very safe Tory seat. But the last time I met Robin was in Whitehall, a few weeks before he was murdered. And I can assure you, he didn't look as though he was a man who was about to snuff it. You didn't think, oh, God, am I ever going to see Robin again? The poor chap looks a bit ill. He was hale and hearty when I last saw him. There's no question he was murdered. He was thrown down the mountain. He didn't fall down it. He was murdered because somebody was concerned that he was going to go public with some very damaging intelligence he had, which might have catapulted Britain out of the European Union. The motives for his murder, I think, are very clear. Apart from anything else, Robin Cook was in the loop on the Diana assassination. I'm sure he wasn't in the loop before she was murdered, but he worked out very quickly that she had been murdered. And part of the reason for that is that he'd given a very silly speech in Manila blaming paparazzi for her death. If you check the records, I think you'll find that Robin was in Manila on the night that Diana was murdered. The speech he gave in the Philippines was far too well informed to be given by a man who'd just been dragged out of bed in the early hours of the morning and told that Diana was dead. Robin's speech was based on a briefing from MI6, But Robin, I think, very quickly worked out that somebody in Six was in the loop. He was right about that. A very senior MI6 officer was in Paris on the night that Diana was murdered. What he didn't know is that these officers were working for the Germans. But the Germans had assets in Six, and they were...
You're talking about Sherrod Cowper-Coles there.
I'm certainly not saying Sherrod Cowper-Coles is a German asset, so I'm not a big fan of Sherrod Cowper-Coles, but I wouldn't suggest that he was involved in the murder of Diana for one moment. And if I did, your lawyers wouldn't let you broadcast the interview. But there were German assets, GO2 assets, inside MI6. Not all of them would have known they were working for the Germans. Some of the GO2 boys thought the GO2 was a British operation. Some of the GO2 boys and I sat down and had a drink, and I explained, look, boys, you're working for the Jerrys. They were pretty appalled. They went away, checked it out, realised I was right. And ever since, we've had a good stream of intelligence out of GO2. It's one of the reasons I know that Thames Valley Police are penetrated by GO2. And Robin was a pretty shrewd chap. He had a brain, Robin. He was not like Tony Blair. He had a first-class mind. And Robin worked out that Diana had been murdered, and I suspect it was the Diana murder which was the motive for bumping Robin off. There's no doubt Robin was murdered. I mean, a political opponent, very good on his feet, a quick thinker, had a fine mind, first-class mind, very intelligent, and I liked him. I absolutely deplore his murder. It was absolutely outrageous. You cannot go around murdering former foreign secretaries. I simply don't approve of it. My view is that he was assassinated in order to stop him talking about Diana. The Diana inquest was coming up. There was a real fear that the truth might come out. In the end, the inquest was a farce. No offence intended to Mr. Justice Scott Baker, but there was always a concern that there might be a proper coroner. By that, I mean a medically trained coroner, not a judge. Judges don't have medical training, and they don't make very good coroners. It's absolutely clear he was assassinated. Absolutely clear that that was to silence him, and I think tolerably clear that he by then had come to the conclusion that Diana had been murdered and some people in London were in the loop. That was probably the motive for the decision to sanction him.
Well, quite a lot in there. That was Michael Shrimpton, who's a columnist on the website Veterans Today, as well as a barrister, not a QC, as I mistakenly said last week. Well, time to sign off now, but time for the typical topical Afro-tropical show. Dial 0117 955 3721 to join Cyrus the Virus. Thanks to our guest in the first hour, Lib Dem Councillor for Horfield and former candidate for Avon and Somerset Police Commissioner Pete Levy. thisweek.org.uk is where you'll find this show. I'm Tony Gosling. Have a good weekend.
BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 7, more than 1,300 people are out of work tonight after Jessup's